Welcome to the latest episode of Global Class, a podcast where we explore the international expansion stories of the world's fastest growing companies and the career journeys of their globally minded leaders. My name is Klaus Wehe, and I'm here with my co-host, Aaron McDaniel.
Thanks, Klaus. In this episode, we're excited to welcome Marvin Liao. Marvin is a partner at Diaspora Ventures and Game Groove Capital, and previously was a partner at 500 Startups, where in total he has invested in over 400 companies. Prior, Marvin played a major role in the international expansion efforts at Yahoo in Asia-Pac and EMEA regions. In our conversation, Marvin shares why it's crucial to build an internal network and trust to be successful in new markets, the pitfalls of too much localization and autonomy, the importance of two-way innovation, why bad economic times are great opportunities to expand in international markets, and viewpoints on how investing in fast-growing companies is getting more global. Marvin, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. And this is a fun conversation because for everyone else, you know, Marvin has been a great supporter of Klaus and I and what we've done to help build global entrepreneurs and ecosystems across the world. And you're joining us from your native Canada, but you've talked to us from the US, from Taiwan, from Georgia, the country, not the state in the US. So it's great to have you, Marvin.
Thanks for having me.
Most will know Marvin as an investor in previous roles with 500 Startups, among other investment firms. But there is also an international career you had prior to that that has sort of led to your mindset of mm-hmm. being an international investor, not a typical Silicon Valley investor who only looks at, you know, a certain type of more narrow company. So would love if you can maybe walk us through a little bit of that journey you had, you know, going back to your Yahoo days or even before that, for where you got your global mindset from.
So, you know, immigrant kid, so I grew up in Canada and so was pretty international, just, you know, spending a lot of time traveling, you know, back to Taiwan, you know, grew up in Canada, which is fairly international as well too. And so I actually lived in Europe and Taiwan for a couple of years, actually after I graduated from university, before I actually started my career in Silicon Valley. So I had a lot of fits and starts with my career. My resume was a complete disaster, probably up until like age 26, 27, you know, trying to figure out sort of what you were meant to do. You know, when I moved to Silicon Valley in early 1999, the first job I had was actually a domestic job. It was an e-commerce company that is a Libra, so sold like out of print books online and had raised like $64 million. So I was a very early employee there. And those first 2 years were really domestic focused, and the dot-com bubble actually ended up sort of imploding. And so, you know, that company didn't do very, very well. So got laid off like everybody in 2001. And I lucked out actually joining Yahoo, you know, sort of as it sort of rose again in 2001 in the international marketing group. And so that's actually where I started my career and then started taking a lot of international roles. So I spent almost 10 and a half years doing international expansion for Yahoo. And so that's actually where the international, I think, you know, lived abroad for many years, but, you know, especially this part was Yahoo was the thing that actually really, really sort of like set me on my career. So I was on the road, you know, about 2 to 3 weeks every single month, you know, going to new countries. You know, I spent a lot of time in I literally went to like 45 different countries while I was over there. And so it was, you know, it's an incredible experience, right? For a relatively young person. And you learn a lot of things the hard way. And I also think at a fairly entrepreneurial organization at Yahoo at that time, when I joined Yahoo, it was like 2,800 people. You know, when I left 10 and a half years later on, the company was about like 15,000 people after we fired 5,000 people, right? So watching the growth, it was a very entrepreneurial organization that kind of let you do whatever you wanted to do, right? As long as you delivered. There was a lot of coaching or guidance. So you learned a lot of these things sort of the hard way, but they gave you the resources to try new things all the time. That sort of is hopefully a quick summary of sort of my career. And then I joined 500 Startups afterwards as a partner, you know, after sort of Yahoo, and also did a lot of international. So 500 was probably far ahead of its time when it came to global sort of like investments. So I spent a ton of time leveraging a lot of my contacts and network to invest internationally. So out of my portfolio, 400 plus companies, a third of them were actually from outside the US. And most of my successful companies were actually from all over the place, like, you know, France, Germany, Brazil, Russia, you know, like the Baltic region and Canada. So it's just sort of, I've really bought into sort of the global opportunity.
Let's talk a little bit more about that experience at Yahoo. And I mean, I forgot the exact numbers, but like, you know, the employee base increased 8x, right, during that time you were there.
that's growing pretty fast from that size to even a bigger size. Mm-hmm. How did the view on international change over time? Was there any specific inflection points? Like in our research, Klaus and I had seen from time to time, the companies that hit certain inflection points of, depending on the type of company, number of users from other countries or amount of revenue from other countries, to then all of a sudden being much more open to not being home market biased. What did you see through that journey?
I mean, truth of the matter is like one of the reasons that sort of I liked international was that you had to be fairly entrepreneurial, partly because the US was the driver of the business for a long time, at least in the early days. We had a fairly large international presence just through organic growth in general. And so that was a good part. But, you know, truth of the matter is that Yahoo didn't really focus hard on international until probably like 2007 or so, like I'd say 2006, 2007. So it was like very late in my career. So first like 5 years in, like we were an afterthought. And then it realized like, oh, wow, like this is actually where like all the growth is actually coming from this region, right? And the irony of it is just because of the investments that Yahoo had actually made, whether through acquisitions or investments. So for example, like investing in Yahoo Japan, right, with SoftBank, or investing in Alibaba, you know, the joke near the end of my stay at Yahoo was that Yahoo was basically an Asian holding company that happened to have a US portal on the side, right? Because all the valuation came from, you know, literally came from our holdings from these, you know, from these assets that we actually owned out in Asia. And then the other thing that was actually interesting near the end of my career was like almost all the user growth was actually from outside of the US.
You talked a little bit about, or Aaron addressed it a little bit earlier about the sort of the organizational biases, having been successful in the US and then started to go international. How did you deal with those organizational biases as someone that were part of that team that helped the company expand to international markets? But then at the same time also, how did you deal with your own blind spots? Because we had a conversation about this earlier before jumping on the call when going international as well. How did you deal with blind spots on your side when being in that market, but then at the same time also dealing with the biases of the organization as well?
One of the things, Yahoo was what I call like a gray company. Like there wasn't a lot of processes even in the later stage. And so it was so very relationship oriented. And so I was very, very fortunate the first couple of years of my career there. I worked on two very, very high profile projects like HSBC PayDirect and the FIFA World Cup. I ran online marketing for the FIFA World Cup. That actually enabled me to build relationships in almost every single group and department, right? You know, at senior levels of even all the way to sort of like C-level, I met a lot of the senior executives because of that role. And also to the most junior sort of like sales operations, customer service sort of roles, because it was all encompassing. So I met, you know, I literally built my network from those two projects. And part of it was just like, actually, I just spent almost all my time like bribing them, taking out for coffees, bribing like engineers, like what they wanted, right? Like, yeah, give them like, you know, swag from like the World Cup or gifts from the World Cup. And every time I travel, I come back and bring like chocolates and things for them. And so I literally built these like relationships and credibility, right? Of just like everything I said I was going to do, I actually did, right? And so managing expectations very clearly. So I built trust with them. And so when I asked them to do something, they're like, oh, I know you, you're good. So we'll go push this through. And that actually set me very, very well for the rest of my career there. So, you know, when I ran sales operations, when I ran like global sales operations, when I ran ad products, you know, the launches, you know, when I did sales strategy, all these roles, when I ran the emerging markets, sort of like expansion markets, a lot of these roles were built on the back of like, okay, like, hey, I need this thing, like this campaign, really, really important campaign with this very, very important client needs to go up. You know, my team is like sleeping in, you know, in Europe. And so like, hey, can somebody in the US push this? I go to, you know, a contact in sales operations and go, hey, can you do me a favor and like push this ad? And they would do it, right? And that'd be like, you know, $1 million. So like, you know, that's really, really important. That was really, really helpful for me to sort of just get stuff done.
One of the big keys, as you just said, was building trust and bringing chocolate. Is that yeah. right?
Yeah, well, I mean, whatever they wanted, right? Like, because whatever they wanted.
Awesome. We actually had a conversation last night for another podcast recording with Masami Takahashi. He led expansion for WeWork and Uber and now Miles into Japan. And there was one quote he said was basically the important aspect of a leader that drives international strategy and expansion is to help people fall in love with the country. But it kind of sounds like you spend a lot of time having people fall in love with you. Is that true?
That was a big part. And then the other thing that I did was I would bring out a lot of like key US people to these countries and do these road trips and then introduce them to the local team. So basically making those connections. And so they would also fall in love with the country, because especially like you go to Asia and Latin America, just like the incredible hospitality. And so they just fell in love, but also a lot of times they're just like seeing it. So being like their local sort of like guide, where it's like, all right, like, let's come out, you know, meet like the senior executives of, you know, like the heads and managing directors of these like regional offices and learn more about what's going on. And a lot of times, like, I vividly remember this conversation where it's like that we had this, you know, the sales engineer come out and he realized like, wow, like all the things that you were saying before, like, I understand now, right? Like, I'm seeing this mistake, like in front of my face, right? And so like, we're going to go fix this right now. There's a level of empathy that you don't have, you know, when you're from headquarters and you're focusing on US problems. And when you show up in these countries, you're like, okay, like you get that sort of like, you see the light bulb go off. And so I spent a lot of time bringing, you know, fairly senior people and key people all over the organization back in the US to the overseas offices to really, really build those ties. That was a big part of the job too.
In talking about trust, you had keyed in on one of the four commitments for successful global growth. And I'm curious maybe if we could go through some of the others and talk about how they were important in your experience in building that growth or otherwise. So basically that one of them is trust and autonomy. So to allow for you and your local efforts and other local teams to be able to bring in that local flavor and localize appropriately and have that independence to do so. Another being resource alignment, so that you're not only given the resources, but over a long enough period of time. You know, this is not a 6 or 9 or 12 month mm-hmm. thing that, you know, has to catch fire, but can take 2-3 years plus. That sustained resource is important. Yeah. Then, as you've been alluding to too, is this communication and clarity that needs to happen, or what Klaus and I call it is like these feedback loops that needs to happen, where company culture is being translated to local teams. And then these local market insights are being sent back to headquarters to have support of localizations. And then finally, our global layer on top of agile, where you aren't able to just blindly iterate in different markets, because then that creates a bunch of different models that are hard to manage. But being mindful of the complexity it creates and creating some structure around what can be localized and what can't to allow for scale. Love if you can maybe talk about those other three besides the autonomy and trust and how they played a role and was effectively done at Yahoo or not, or the other company.
You know, in regards to like the resource alignment, that was a challenge, right? And so, like I said, there was a gray market here where you had to sort of like pull. And so one of Yahoo's biggest issues is that there wasn't clear delineation of, you know, sort of like local versus sort of like central, you know, like what happened was just, these were very, very autonomous organizations. And so what ended up happening, because a lot of them didn't feel that they could actually rely on sort of like central resources, they start end up building up their own. So there's a lot of replication. And so, you know, almost every, this is pretty much the same for most organizations I've seen, is that there's this toggle between sort of like centralized versus sort of like decentralized all the time. And that was very, very debilitating for the organization. That's something I think Yahoo is not particularly good at. The other thing that I don't think Yahoo is particularly good at is really the, what I would call sort of like the playbook, right? Of just like, let's go and take the playbook that works. Like, for example, like certain business models, it makes a lot more sense. So for example, like eBay, I knew a lot of people did international on eBay. It's a marketplace business, right? So the eBay marketplace had a very specific playbook that when they were going to new market, they would use the quote unquote eBay playbook. Their biggest problem was that there was not a lot of flexibility in sort of like adapting that playbook locally. You know, Yahoo's issue was that we were too adaptable in the local market. So you end up having these fully autonomous organizations. And then what would happen is just, and we saw that this is one of the reasons we lost search, was that we actually end up centralizing the development of search and we end up making it local to local execution when it should have been a global execution. And that's why we're not able to get the critical mass, you know, for search and for the search ad product. And that's why we lost, right? That's why Google kicked our ass. We were the first one, right? Like, under Overture. And that was a blinding lesson where just our own bad execution in this sort of like over-localization was actually the problem.
To the comment you made about centralized to localized, we refer to that as the pendulum that you often are shifting between different functions and as you expand in different areas and get more of a thing. But that there is an art to that, to know when you need to do what. And I think the what sometimes gets over talked about is this command and control headquarters telling everyone what to do and making it a homogeneous footprint. But what also can happen, like you said, is going too far in the other direction and letting every local team have the autonomy to do whatever they want. And then all of a sudden you lose that collective cohesion that allows for supporting that scale.
When I did the EMEA expansion markets, that was actually the biggest issue, is that we were, you know, like our team was very entrepreneurial, and the local requirements, because of our sort of like weak standing in the local markets, and just because of what local market standard, we just weren't fast enough in turnaround for campaigns because we were reliant on an European sort of like ad operations team. And that was a huge, huge issue, you know, to sort of like to our growth. And actually probably one of the reasons I laughed was just like, this is just not working anymore. It's just too hard, right? So, but 10 and a half years is a long run.
So you then were at Yahoo, and then I see that you were a little bit of an individual consultant to other companies that were going international, right? What was some of the key learnings that you took then from Yahoo and then helped other companies with when it came to the topic of international expansion?
It is interesting that sort of a lot of what I do now is sort of like the expansion stuff, right? And so a lot of it was just helping them think through the playbook. A lot of them is helping them sort of like think through prioritization of like which markets to go after. A lot of times these very, very smart sort of executives and founders are like, well, I'll do it all. And that's right. Usually not a recipe for success. And also depending on the type of market that you would be going after, right? So for example, like back then it was en vogue to sort of go to China or go to sort of like markets like Japan or even like the UK market. And one of the biggest mistakes I think a lot of American companies make is like the first market they choose is UK because, oh, they speak our language and the same culture. So it'll be fine, right? And, you know, for me personally, I found the UK market to be one of the more challenging markets. Right. It's like, yeah, they speak the same language, but just like culturally very, very different. The communications in general versus say, for example, like you go to Japan, Japan's not an easy market to go to, but it's like, yeah, but because I know it's not an easy market to go to, so different that you're just much more aware of those challenges and you're much more aware of the traps that could actually come up when you go to a new market like that versus like UK or Canada. It's like, oh, these are easy markets. I will just go in. It'll be super simple. And it's like, usually not. Like those tend to be sort of like when you overlook a lot of things.
That's what we call in our book, the familiarity bias, that companies tend to go to the markets that's geographically similar or have the same language, right? So we see a lot of this, the common mistakes that companies make. Actually, typically the companies from the Bay Area will think about UK, Canada, Australia, et cetera. And in Latin America, it's typically the near markets down there, you know, Spanish speaking and so forth.
Or that, Spain going to Latin America, right?
Exactly. So I guess, how have you helped companies then prioritize the right type of markets and not just those typical familiar markets that they tend to expand to?
A lot of the work is really like just, you know, back then you're looking at sort of like where the internet growth is, you know, size of the populations, you know, ad spend, right? Because of the related to sort of what I did before, you kind of take a bunch of these things and you kind of lay them out on a graph and just go, all right, like, and then you probably add another filter of just, like I said, that familiarity filter of just like, okay, where do you have an edge, right? Like, do you have like ties in these countries, you know, whatever it is, right? Like even the competitive benchmarking, like who are the local players, right? Like, you know, from a product set and whatnot. So you kind of put all these multiple things together to sort of come up with your list. And then it's just a matter of just like, okay, how much time we've been allowed to sort of run the experiments and sort of see what's going to work. And also what are the metrics of success? Like, what did that look like, right? Like if you're expecting like, you know, massive growth in one quarter and without sort of like really a lot of this groundwork and this experimentation, I'm just like, that's just not realistic either, right? And I do think a lot of folks have very unrealistic expectations of, or they expect international expansion to be very, very easy. I don't know why anybody thinks that's going to be easy, right? Like that is continually shocking to me.
Yeah, typically where we come in supporting companies that they have already sort of thought about the markets they want to go to, like have like 3 to 5 different target markets, but really don't know where to prioritize or where to start. And that's sort of where we come in to help them think about, okay, how can we do what we call localization discovery in identifying how do we need to change if we're deciding to scale into XYZ markets? And so I don't know if some of you, from your experience, you've seen companies doing that due diligence up front, or if it's more like looking at that data that usage around the world and say, okay, we're going to invest into here. What were some of the learnings that you've had in working with all these companies? Do they actually go into the market, talk to key stakeholders, try to fully identify how that business model needs to change, and then invest? Or how does it typically work from your experience?
My experience is I find like what ends up happening is they kind of stumble in you know, they do a little bit of analysis, but they kind of stumble. Like, it's almost like this sort of like very, very like wide variance, right? Like, you have a bunch of folks who are like, there's a lot of due diligence and then nothing gets done, right? There's right. no execution, or there's like no due diligence and they kind of like stumble into it and they're like, oh crap. And then they have to go and figure it out. I would say Yahoo's experience was probably more on the no due diligence. Let's just go figure this thing out. I mean, I learned a lot doing that, but it's I don't know if I would, that would be the approach I would I would take in the future.
So you talked about one of the gaps that maybe you saw Yahoo having was not having any kind of cohesive form of a playbook to use for different places or organizations that maybe stick too tight to this is the one way to do things versus localizing otherwise. Let's talk about this notion of building a brain trust, especially early on as you're entering new markets. How important is that? What are some of the keys to success when building that brain trust of key insights about individual markets and then about multiple markets so you can replicate things and create some momentum as you enter more?
For me personally, I had to learn all this stuff the hard way. You know, bear in mind, like, you know, when I was coming up in the world, like LinkedIn wasn't a thing, right? So it wasn't if you could go reach out. So you would informally maybe know like one or two people. And so this is why, like, I think like what you guys are doing, Global Class, is so great with the community that you're building, because like now you can do that. It's much easier to reach out to sort of like other people who've done like international expansion and just like, hey, what are the things you learned? There's starting to be some community that's being built around that we can share knowledge. That didn't really exist. Like, it wasn't easy to go and find these people. Like, you really, really had to work very, very hard to go find these folks versus now. And so, you know, I had to learn a lot of this stuff from either, you know, my bosses, and even for some of them, they were trying to figure this stuff out too, right? So it wasn't a very, very common thing in the 2000s. Like, yes, there's a lot of people who did international expansion, say for Pepsi or Coke, but not for a lot of like the software or digital, you know, like digital media stuff. So kind of had to learn this stuff myself. So I literally had to go read every single sort of like international global expansion book that I possibly that existed, right? And they're not fun or interesting to read, right? But I needed these frameworks. So that's how I built the frameworks. It was just like, wow, like there's nowhere else. Like there's nobody I can talk with really, except for a couple of people in the organization. So I just go read like as many books as I possibly could have done. And that's kind of how I figured it out. And then by making a lot of mistakes.
I'm curious about these books, because in our research, we haven't really seen many books on the topic, which is why we wrote Global Class.
Well, it was more like how to do international business, right? Like those type of books versus sort of like doing international expansion. Also, the other thing that I'd say is just sort of, you're looking at sort of much more tech. I was reading like a lot more of like, oh, like how did Procter & Gamble do, like, you know, like reading the story of Procter & Gamble, how they did their international expansion, and or Amex, right? Amex was a typical, you know, there's this really, really great book that I read that I still have, that I still go back, because it makes like any MBA cringe, because it's like all the stuff they teach you in school where it's like, wow, like this is how they really did it. And it was like total mess, right? You know, that was helpful to some extent, you know, not directly helpful, but sort of indirectly just sort of helped me build my playbook and framework.
So are you telling me that the stuff that I learned at school, the SWOT analysis, the PEST analysis, and all those frameworks doesn't work at all?
I mean, they're useful as frameworks, just as frameworks to figure stuff out, right? But like, you know, from when it came to sort of like the day-to-day, it was just sort of like, okay, that's helpful for prioritization, other things like that. But for day-to-day execution, wasn't particularly useful.
So what were some of the frameworks that you developed yourself that were practical and useful that you build up within the team?
Well, I think the two most interesting things that was helpful for me was being able to go and take, as learning all the time, like, you know, I built a telesales team in India, for example, and that allowed me to go meet like the telesales team in Europe and in say the US that were very, very successful, and really going and borrowing like what they did to sort of like launch, right? And so I literally took playbooks from other organizations and kind of rejiggered them for international and tried to experiment with them, you know, overseas. And so I did a lot of that. And so, you know, I did a lot of really built, like I said, I spent a lot of time building the ties and network, right, within the organization. And I spent a lot of time trying to learn the best practices and going to sort of like the top operators in the Yahoo organization and, you know, just asking them sort of like, hey, if you were me, what would you do? What did you learn from doing these things? And kind of like redeploying a lot of that stuff and taking them to sort of these overseas markets. I spent a lot of time internally building ties, and that's sort of what I came up with.
You haven't necessarily said this directly, but I think it ties into something that we found a lot in our research. And that's that to date, this experience of international expansion has been a very solitary one. You were out there having to go figure this out yourself, reading books, build your own network. I think another moment that was particularly illuminating for Klaus and I actually involved you, where one of the other people who support us in our programs, Troy Malone.
Yeah, he's my buddy.
You guys are buddies. But you guys were both, to my understanding, if I remember the story correctly, you were both in, I think it was maybe Taiwan or somewhere else at the same time, launching businesses, but you know, you didn't even know each other existed because it was just such a, like, I got to go figure this out on my own, nowhere to go, no LinkedIn, other things like that. And so talk a little bit about that whole thing. Obviously, Klaus and my goal is to make things, as Klaus likes to say, a shared experience instead of a solitary one. But talk about what that was like, you know, talk maybe more about building that network and why that was important internally to get the resources and trust and communication and those other four commitments we talked about before.
Well, a big part is just like, you don't know what you don't know, right? I think doing international business, you know, ends up sort of like making you pretty humble, because as you build the playbooks, you start figuring out, you know, hey, 80%, like we know like this 80% probably should work. Then you're going in locally to go and figure out what that 20% difference is, right? Whether it's consumer differences, whether it's sort of like competitive differences. And, but having said that, like a lot of times is sort of, because I did a lot of like new market launches, I had to go build that over time. And so what happens in the beginning is just sort of the first sort of like 10 or so market launches that you do in the beginning usually don't work out very well. You just, you know, it's like getting punched in the head, right? Like all the time. And you, you know, there's certain things where it's like, well, this worked in the US, it should work here. And then you realize that, yeah, okay, this is, I was so far off on this. Truth of the matter, you learn from pain. And so after you kind of get kicked in the head a couple of times, you get better about like asking the right questions. You get better about like finding the right partners and all that other stuff, right? And even hiring the right people into these markets. Like these are all the things you only learn by doing and doing badly, right? Like that's actually the truth. You learn by doing badly. And so after a while, like I would say my hit rate became much better by the time I got to like market number 15 or market number 20, where it's like, all right, I'm pretty sure this is going to work, but here's some, these are like the 15 to 20% of things I need to go figure out, like local staffing things, or like I need to understand about like this and this and this and this, right? Depending on what the market is. And so you just kind of get better. And then over time, like that 20% becomes like 10%. Every time you think you have it figured out, you just get whacked in the back of the head, right? So this is a very, very humbling process. But boy, you learn a crap ton.
I'm laughing because what you're saying reminds me of my favorite Mike Tyson quote. Not that there are that many of them, but he says, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face. Yeah.
And if, when you do international, you just get prepared for it, right? You're like, yeah, I know I'm going to get punched. I'm not sure where, but I know I'm going to get punched, and we'll, you know, like, and I'll just deal with it, right? You start developing the confidence and you understand that you can deal with it. And that's a big part of it. Like, that's a big part of it. And also making sure that you actually have gotten buy-in from your headquarters and your bosses to give you enough time to go and figure this out, right? Of just like, I signed up for a lot of stuff, that, you know, a lot of targets that were unrealistic in the beginning. And in near the end, I got a little bit better, where I'm just like managing expectations on both sides, on everybody's side, right? Of just whether local partners or even back at headquarters, where it's like, look, this is going to take at least 2 quarters while we figure this out. Like, you need to give me at least 2 quarters while we, you know, versus sort of like, no, I expect revenue right away from day one. I didn't understand at the beginning, right? Maybe overly confident early in my career.
Let's talk about those two sides a little bit from a team building perspective, right? Because you've built teams around the world. And what Aaron and I have done, we've built a team building framework that supports companies in thinking about how you build those teams. And so one aspect of it is what we call sort of the bridge between local knowledge and company knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's important that you have that overlap, where when you build teams, you have to have that local business experience, obviously local language skills, the local networks, as Aaron alluded to a little bit earlier. And even sometimes the person that leads that market that has the pride in local, in that local culture as well. But then on the other side, you also need to make sure that you have the company knowledge when you build those teams. Someone like you that comes from obviously a headquarter, understands how things work internally, understands the company culture, and also has that trust built in. You alluded to it a little bit earlier. Did you spend a lot of time building that internal trust within the organization? How did you approach in building teams in, internationally? Did you think about this overlap when you built teams, or was it also one of the realizations that sort of came to you after having gone through a lot of these mistakes that you made, obviously not having the full experience before?
I had just seen so many people not do well at international, like we take a US person and then drop them overseas and just be a total disaster. Right. I also think there was at least at Yahoo I saw, this is probably a gross generalization, but just there was a level of, frankly, ignorance and arrogance that a lot of the US guys, and usually guys, actually had about the international markets. Because a lot of them, let's be frank, most Americans don't travel, right? So they're like, oh, they're just like us. So this is very easy. And they went out there like, oh, wow. Like, so for example, like one mark we got the crap kicked out was like Korea. It's like such a, you know, South Korea for the record, right? South Korea's super competitive market. We were number one and we just started dropping. Like in 2001, we were number one. 2002, we dropped to number two. 2003, we dropped to number three. 2004, we dropped to number four because of just a lack of investment and also just lack of understanding because they're like, wait a minute, we're Yahoo. We should dominate here. We didn't realize just how crazy competitive the local market was. And also, I think some of the, it was a harvest market where it's like, okay, hey, we put enough money into this market. Let's harvest the crap out of this without actually investing. So competitive, right? You know, for anyone who knows the South Korean market, particularly the internet market, I mean, they're one of the most like innovative markets, like bar none. And that was something I think a lot of the folks back in the US just didn't understand at all. And a lot of them just didn't really travel. Just sort of like, you just will not see until you go out there and you're like, holy, like I remember showing up in the market in 2001, I was like, holy crap, like these folks are so far ahead, right? On many, many fronts. And there wasn't a willingness, you know, necessarily to invest to sort of like keep that edge. Maybe to answer your question, where there's an element of sort of understanding sort of like what's happening in the US market and having locals and our job, at least, I like to think I did my best here. I don't know if I did a good job, was to sort of translate a lot of this stuff, right? You know, to both sides, where it's like, okay, local team, here's sort of the constraints back home. Here's some of the best practices, how we adapt them here. Because ad sales was, you know, we had an incredible ad sales team in the US market. It's probably the best ad sales team. So we adopted a lot of things they had, but vice versa, where it's like on the product side, it's like, wow, like Korea's super far ahead. We should take them. And we took a lot of the innovations from Hong Kong, from Taiwan, from Korea back to the US market, right? From a product perspective. And so that was one of the roles that we actually did. But I think one of the problems, especially when it comes from the main money market, you know, the main money-making market at the time was the US, there was a level of cockiness and arrogance where it's like, what's wrong with these other folks? Like, why can't they do what we're doing right now without really understanding the different resource bases, without really understanding sort of the competitive edge that the US market actually had, right? So just a lot of that's just sort of lost in translation sometimes.
I'm interested in learning a little bit more about the piece you talked about in terms of the insights you got from international markets into the product innovation and brought that back to more of the global organization and scaled it out to other markets. What were some of those like innovations that you guys uncovered in international markets that then could be used in other places as well?
So, you know, from a consumer market, I would say Japan, Korea, like Taiwan, like, you know, pretty far ahead, right? If you think about it. So for example, like when you go to search, you type in a word on search, and all of a sudden there's like autofill of like key sort of like terms. You know, for us actually was something that was started out of Taiwan. And no, it was Hong Kong. I'm sorry. It's actually out of Hong Kong. And then that was adapted actually back in the US market as an example, like that one vividly. Because I remember I was like, wow, like Hong Kong kind of figured this stuff out. Right. And then it was like, wow, this is a great idea. And it literally spread all across sort of like the rest of the search products in the world. That was one that sort of stuck out at me. The other one was, I think, like building out like a sales strategy team. That was one of the best practices that we actually had in the US market. And that was something I actually spent a lot of time going and helping build all across the world and actually spending a lot of time training, right? Like how to think about sort of like how you sell to agencies versus how you sell to direct clients and the case studies and things that you put together, right? You know, the formats of like the presentations, like that helped us like look very, very professional and very, very good in these local markets.
I think we touched a little bit on it, but a lot of the stuff we talked about was obviously your personal experience, kind of being that internal evangelist to move the needle within the organization. But I'm curious to learn a little bit more about the structures and processes you guys set up to ensure this feedback loop were happening between local markets and also the headquarters. For example, in the book, we developed what we call a localization resource team, which is sort of a structure you can build that's cross-functional that gets the responsibilities to support fast localization of those local markets. What were some of the structures and processes that you guys established to make sure those feedback loops were stronger and not just from one individual person that communicates from afar and say, this needs to happen?
So what happened was we were fairly decentralized in the beginning. And then what happened, I think it's like 2003, 2004, we hired a head of international operations and he built out. And so my team, you know, the team that I was part of, as well as some other teams, was basically built out under him to coordinate and prioritize product launches, international expansion. And that worked for maybe like 2 or 3 years, but I didn't get along with the head of international. I found it to be a little bit arrogant. And what ended up happening was just sort of, there was a calling. And so they just ended up like, you know, firing him. And then, you know, what happened was just our group was basically split apart. And so I ended up, a lot of the power and decision-making was then pushed out to the local regions. So there was a big reorg. This was, must have been back in 2007. And what ended up happening was the reorg actually, you know, all the central international teams were basically disbanded. And then all the power was basically pushed to these like organizations of like, you know, North Asia, you know, sort of emerging markets, Europe, and then sort of like the North America market. And so I ended up joining the emerging markets team to basically work on, and the emerging markets team was at that time was like Southeast Asia, India, Latin America. And then I kind of ran everything else, right? So I ran, you know, sort of like the Central Eastern Europe and Middle East Africa. And so that was sort of like the emerging markets team. So I became sort of like more of a, you know, that's actually when I started having like P&L experience. So that was pretty much the structure for the, at least for the last 4 years, 4.5 years I was there.
So I'd love to tie a lot of what you're talking about with some of your experience that came after in supporting startups and in, you know, whether it be in advisory capacity, working with incubators, et cetera. So just looking at list, Thailand, Hungary, Israel, Belarus, Poland, Turkey, Italy, Bulgaria, Estonia. You were talking a couple of times about the arrogance that might come from headquarters. And I think some of that ties into this different view on international, depending on where you come from. So if you come from a larger market, US or others, where you're thinking about international much later, it's very different than if you come from Estonia or Hungary or Israel, or one of these other countries where they know that their home market is not big enough to create that scaled business they want. So they're thinking outside their borders from the beginning. So I would love you to juxtapose some of that experience you had at Yahoo versus what you've seen with companies that have come after that aren't born in a large market.
I think companies that are born in a small market actually have an edge because, you know, they don't have these biases of the large home markets. If you look at sort of like some of the companies that sort of, even though it's a lot of American companies are global, boy, like they're not great at it, right? Because they're just like, they have the large home market. And you look at other companies like, you know, coming out of like, you know, with exception of some of the consumer brands and automotive brands, like, you know, Japanese companies or Chinese companies, like they're not great because their home market's so big. German companies, I don't find German companies be particularly good at like international expansion because they have such a huge home market. France is the same example because they have a big enough home market. Like they're like, just focus on this, right? It's good enough already. There's a comfort level there. And that's very, very different in places like Israel or like Estonia, where like it's a tiny market where it's like, it's very, very hard to build a massive business just based on Estonians, like what is it, 1 million people or 2 million people? Yeah. Like it's such a tiny population. Israel's like 8 million people. And so you have the advantage of a mindset thing where it's like, well, we have nothing to lose anyways. And if you're going to go big, you really do have to go big, right? Like to sort of like make, to build any scale as a business. And so this is actually why they have an edge.
The other thing that Klaus and I are finding is how, well, we have our own thoughts about how things are going to change over time. And one thing we like to say is that global is the new agile. And yeah, that kind of sounds cool, but to unpack it a little bit, companies kind of understand this agile lean methodology already. It's sort of baked in from the beginning now, but there's other commonalities where just like with the waterfall methodology versus the lean methodology, the agile methodology, you have to have everyone bought into either side, because if people don't agree, you're going to have problems. And that's true of our global class mindset. But the other piece is how, you know, because of this more iterative approach, it's not some big launch that happens anymore where, you know, this is the launch date and it's much more iterative and changes over time. And we think global will continue down that way as well. It's not like, let's go hire an office in London of 20 people and have a ribbon cutting. It's like, we're going to go test this out even before we hire someone and dip this in. And so that's where we think international is going, which I think is what you're saying is more of that small market, like companies that come from that small market thinking about it earlier. Love just some of your comments.
That sounds about right. There's these best practices, lean startup. And so I'm an investor now. And so I spend a lot of time working with companies and I mentor a lot of different startup accelerators as well too, particularly from overseas. And this is something I see, even if you raise quite a lot of money back in your home market in Europe, whether you're moving to the Japanese market or moving to the US market, like their blind spot is like, well, hey, this thing works pretty well here. Like, let's just do the same thing in the US. And I'm like, no, like you're going to have to sort of do a lot of experimentation and you got to do a lot of iteration. And the reality is that you almost have to treat it like a completely brand new market. Like you don't know anything and treat it like a sort of look at it like a blank piece of paper. If you do that, your likelihood of success is going to be higher versus you come in with like, I'm just going to take what I have from before and sort of like launch it here into this market. Usually I have not seen that work. So it's changed a lot, right? Like lean startup does work. But you go in, you start the customer discovery process again. All the things that you did to sort of like get product market fit in your home market, you need to do the exact same thing from zero in a new market, especially in a competitive market like the US or Japan, as an example.
Yeah, so we definitely agree with that. I think the caveat that we add to that as well is you can't use the pure agile methodology because when you do that across 5 different markets, 10 different markets, then you have 10 different models. So you have to be mindful of the complexity and put some guardrails up to figure that out. And that's, in light of some of the tools we created as well. Love to give a moment because I think that from the research we've done, business leaders that come from Canada, I think offer a unique perspective because there is cultural similarities between US and Canada as an example, but Canada is a smaller market. It's not as extreme as Estonia with like 2 million people, but we've seen a number of successful companies from Canada use US as their initial market, like Slack and others, but there's a different mindset that you bring that comes from a smaller market, and those paired together can create more success. But would love just the, to give you a soapbox to talk a little bit about that, because I think people lump, Canada and US together, and that's not the way you should look at it.
They're significantly different markets, like just mindset, competitiveness in general, even work ethic things, right? Just like very, very different. And so, it is culture shock for a lot of Canadians, myself too, moving to the US there's a lot of culture shock. And so it's, I would say in general, US companies, like for example, I think Walmart tried coming into the US, Target tried coming to the, very successful in the US, tried coming into Canada. That was not successful. They missed a lot of things. And that they end up losing quite a lot of money. And so Target's an amazing company, right? Like very, very successful company. So they made a lot of those mistakes of like, oh, they're just like us, right? And like, well, there are some differences. And what Canadians coming to the US market, I think they underestimate just how crazy competitive the US market is. The level and quality of sales and marketing that's required to penetrate the US market way higher than they're used to. And so, like I said, those things of just like understanding those little differences or significant differences in this case is very, very critical for success. There have not been a lot of Canadian companies that have done well in the US.
Let's move maybe over to more not your current role, but the role before actually moving on to being an investor at Game Grow Capital, 500 Startups. 500 Startups obviously also expanded all over the world. How is the expansion of a fund different from a startup? Can you share a little bit more about that? Because a lot of investors tend to shy away from investing in international markets because they don't understand the local environment, culture, regulatory environment. They don't really understand how to effectively invest in those markets. How did you guys tackle that as an investor that scaled across the world?
We spend a lot of time traveling, right? So, I was very, very fortunate because I leveraged a lot of the network that I actually had built in my previous life, right? So I went in, like there's a lot of ex-Yahoo people all over the world and in the startup ecosystem and in the investor ecosystem. So that helped a lot. And so I had a little bit of an edge. And I also had a comfort level, I think, with these countries, going out to these countries. I've spent a lot of time in most of these countries already. So between the network and having sort of like familiarity with the culture and whatnot was useful. That's how we did it. And we traveled a lot. That 500 was very early to this, about sort of getting out to the markets very, very early, spending time, with the ecosystem, whether it's other investors or even just investing and talking to founders and doing workshops and things. And so that's basically what we did, just went out there, met and talked to as many different people as we possibly can, had drinks with them, do workshops, try to be helpful, and, you know, interesting, cool companies came out of that.
How do you think the pandemic have changed things in terms of investment opportunities around the world and accelerating innovation, technology trends, ecosystem development? Do you see there's even more opportunities out there from investors now?
I think Zoom, 2 years of sort of lockdowns and 2 years of Zoom calls made people be much more sort of like comfortable with sort of video. Having said that, I think now that the world's kind of opened up, like in the last 6 months, the world's opened up a lot more. You see people like, I'm at least for my portfolio companies right now, you're starting to see with the big companies and customers are like, hey, when are you going to come visit us? And even on the investing side, you're seeing people eventually now want to start meeting the companies. But having said that, it is much easier where it's like people are raising money from all over the world, right? And so the difference is, at least in the process, you know, people had to come to Silicon Valley. That's not always the case now. You might start to do it eventually, but what's happening now is just the first part of these investment calls can be done on Zoom. There's a lot more comfort level to do stuff on Zoom. In early stage, it's fairly easy, right? In later stage, that's probably more of like, I'm talking growth stage and other things. Like they're still probably meet, but at least the first part of the process can be done sort of like on Zoom calls. And so you are seeing that. You're seeing technology adoption in general be fairly high, particularly in the B2B software side, where it's like there's all these new tools now that have been launched. And that is definitely making, sort of, in theory, making work life much easier and better for most folks. And so from a globalization perspective, I think there's a higher comfort level in general of just like investing higher than it ever has been. I can't say it's still perfect, but it's higher than it ever has been in regards to doing deals sort of like globally. You know, so it's an incremental up, right? You know, sort of like up change versus sort of like a degrade, right? So right, you're seeing sort of like it's a little bit better, not dramatically better in my opinion.
I guess where on the spectrum will companies sit in terms of how they build organization from a, you know, distributor standpoint? Because you have the Elon Musk of the world say, we got to go back to the office. And then you have Twitter, we're going to go fully remote. Where do you think companies will sit on that spectrum?
And by the way, Elon Musk may be buying Twitter. So
exactly. Well, it seems like there? They're suing him right now. So it's
yeah, who knows, right? Who knows where that's going to go? But I think a lot of big companies are going to end up sort of doing some hybrid form. You know, like I'm a big proponent of remote work, but not for everybody. Like if you're a terrible manager, remote is awful. I don't think it's particularly good. I think if you are trying to iterate very, very quickly, you kind of need to be together. I think remote works very, very well when you have a fully baked product. I think when you sort of have fully baked processes, I also think when you have, you know, the team has been together or have multiple companies together. I think if you have not spent a lot of time working together, I think remote is really, really awful. And if you're a brand new manager, I think remote will be very challenging for them. But I'm a proponent of remote work. So it depends, right? As always, it really, really depends. And I think my view is that you either have to go fully remote or you go, you know, sort of like in person, because this hybrid thing, I think, is very challenging to operate.
Absolutely. And there's also, even if you're talking remote, it's not just purely that, and you never see each other, it's still finding moments for people to physically get together.
Correct.
Periodically.
Yeah, I mean, Automattic, they get together as an organization, like fully, I think once or twice a year, and the teams itself get together like almost every quarter at least. And so my team at Yahoo, my last two, you know, almost 4 years there was, we were pretty much remote. I was out of headquarters. All my team was everywhere else. We would get together. I would meet them almost every single month, each of the people. And then as a group, we would get together every quarter. That's very, very important.
So now we wanted to transition to looking a little more forward to the future. One question I have is more putting your investor hat on. What we found, Klaus and I, in a number of conversations is, especially in talking to American investors, there's a different view when it comes to international. I think some of that comes from that coming from a larger market piece, but there's such a focus on the US market that I don't think that they're thinking about that global purview. You know, to understand that there are multiples more people outside of the US than in the US. And so what advice would you have for investors who come from a large market to see the opportunities that exist other places and be successful in capturing that in their portfolios?
So the first thing I say is just try to travel, right? Like get a passport and travel. A lot of them don't do that. And so you don't really, seeing is believing. And so, you know, how I was introduced to 500, they used to do these things called, you know, geeks on the plane. And there are other folks doing, I think Southeast Asia, there's somebody doing like 42 geeks. And then one of my portfolio companies, he left his company and now he's doing this. It's called, it's like VU, it's like Ventures Unknown or something like that. It's like VU, you know, Ventures Unknown. I'll send you the link, but like they're basically putting together these trips where they'll go to an ecosystem like Colombia, go to an ecosystem like Tallinn. And it's just like 15 to 20 folks, like either startup people or like investor people. And they'll go and like meet a lot of the local ecosystem players. That's very, very helpful. Or go speak at a conference overseas. And you kind of, you start to see sort of, you learn very, very quickly about where the ecosystem's at, what the opportunities are. So travel, I actually think is really, really important. Like seeing is believing. And also you see how many amazing companies have come to Israel and Estonia now, where it's like you're missing actually opportunities by not going out there.
One of our previous guests, Marcelo Schirmer, from he's from South Africa. He's originally from Europe, but he's working with companies in Africa. He's talking about how there are companies across Africa and other places that are solving problems right now that like people in the U.S. don't even understand.
Yeah, I mean, one of my fastest growing companies is a company called Chipper Cash. I invested in them back in at 500 back in 2018, and I can't tell you how much they're making, but I was shocked. I've never seen a company grow this quickly. Like the amount of just in 5-year period, right? Like it isn't just a valuation thing of just like actually how much revenue they're making, like in the hundreds of millions. It's like, holy crap. Like that is, I was really blown away. And I didn't understand at that time. I just knew he was smart.
Absolutely. Along those lines, and one thing we were talking about before we started recording the podcast was just how there's a shock to the economy right now. Companies are not being able to raise money in whatever terms they want anymore. You got to tighten up a bit. But I think this also could present an opportunity for companies that see that global opportunity. And ultimately, it's in bad times like this, when everyone's paying attention to other things, that some great opportunities come out there for growth and success to solidify yourself. What advice do you have for companies that may see global as an opportunity during these tough economic times when others are focused more inward?
I mean, if you built a good business model and you're profitable, or you have just raised a lot of money, it could be a good opportunity, because like everything's cheaper, right? Like getting talent's cheaper, you know, investing in marketing's cheaper. And actually there's a lot of talent on the, you know, sort of, there's just lots of layoffs and stuff, right? So when you invest in times like this, when your competition is sort of like stepping back, you do see a lot of the better companies actually grow during sort of like tough times like this. And so if you are serious about international, you know, besides getting the Global Class book, right? Like it's a good time to invest and sort of like do it well, because like these are future growth markets for you. And, you know, setting the foundation, if you put a good foundation on the ground, think about, you know, these markets, maybe these markets are going to grow faster than the US and the developed markets in general.
I want to double click on a previous topic we touched on a little bit earlier before we dive into the last section of the podcast, the three pieces of advice. Talked a little bit about Silicon Valley, that companies tend to expand later as they raised maybe a Series C. Typically, from having conversation with other leaders, it's around like late Series C. And I think there's a tendency then for companies in the US to kind of hard code the business around the US market, which makes it very difficult for them to expand down the road. And so what is your recommendation to companies in Silicon Valley? What do you think they should think about international earlier? And if so, how early do you think they should think this way? How early should they think about exploration of international markets? Now, I do get that it will differ depending on the business, the industry, and so forth. But since you've seen so many companies, I'd love to get your perspective on that. And how would that change with the pandemic as well? Yeah.
I don't know if it changed dramatically, but one of the things I will say is just like, I think it's actually about right, because even if you think about what Series C, like late Series C, it's still kind of early to sort of like look at international, because, you know, in theory, you're still baking your business model and you're still learning. You know, typically at Series C, like my guess is you're probably at about 100 million, like, you know, anywhere between 70 to 100 million in revenue. That's my guess, right? I don't spend a lot of time with, you know, I don't spend a lot of time with companies at that stage, but that's sort of like my rough guess. Like that's still early, right? If you think about it, that's still very, very early to sort of like where probably the right number is somewhere like above 100 million in revenue before you sort of like go overseas. But like I said, a lot of it's going to be very, very much dependent on your business model. Like if it's a media business model, you can go international very, very quickly. If it's e-commerce, that's tougher because there's a lot of infrastructure things you need to go and figure out, right? If you're a marketplace business, you can probably do it earlier. And so, like I said, it will depend. If you're fintech, I think it's probably a lot later because of just like all the massive regulatory things you need to go and figure out. So it will depend on the type of business. You know, for most fintech companies, probably like Series D, E, F, you know, at that point in time, right? So it depends. that's actually for fintech, because I do a lot of fintech deals. That's typically like they usually do it like after D or E is what I see, because they're like, oh crap, like you can't underestimate how challenging the regulatory stuff really is.
Do you think companies should think at least global early and not necessarily launching in multiple markets, but for example, hiring international people into the organization?
For sure. I do think that's something they can start, like just, you know, start hiring in, even just from a talent pool perspective of just like, think of how expensive engineers are. Like if you aren't looking at a global talent pool, even just dipping your toes in and hiring folks from Poland or Ukraine or some other place like that, then and I'm just like, what are you doing, right? Or even France, like just like there's great talent in France, particularly from the on the technical side. So that's something I would say at least the difference now is that many of the startup founders now are used to working with engineers from other countries. And so at least that's better than back in the day when you just only hire US folks, right? So, you know, there's a little bit more, it gives me hope that at least there's a little bit more international mindedness now, global mindedness, you know, than there ever has been. And actually, frankly speaking, if you look at sort of 50% of like the entrepreneurial class in general, the very, very successful companies are either immigrants or from other countries. And so that's a big part of my thesis of my rolling fund diaspora, just like it's European pre-seed founders coming to the US market, very, very specific, right? And we have very, very interesting companies that have built massive businesses now in the US.
We're putting you in the hot seat, but imagine you're actually coming down the elevator and you have to answer it very quickly, just like founders have when they have to pitch their company, right? Yeah. So I'll start with the first. What one piece of advice would you give to someone interested in building a career around international business?
Make sure that you travel. That's just, I can't sort of say that enough, right? Like make sure you travel. The other thing I'd also say is just volunteer for everything. Like you have to be super, super entrepreneurial. And so there is something about people, whether it's immigrants, people who travel a lot, like stuff just goes wrong all the time. So you just learn to be flexible. And that's one of those things of just like, if you're looking for stability, if that's what you care about, don't do international. If you don't like change, like do not do international.
I actually have another recommendation for people that travel. It's not just about travel. Don't go to Hot Rock Cafe when you travel. Because that's not really a truly...
Yeah, or McDonald's, know, or McDonald's.
Or like, McDonald's, exactly.
Yeah, don't eat at McDonald's when you travel. Like literally go and experience. Like the more you have to travel. Like if you don't like travel, don't do international. Like there are a lot of people that don't want to do that, right? So it's just like they're not suited, but it does seem sexy.
Second question is, what one piece of advice do you have for a business leader expanding a business to new markets?
Give yourself at least like 2 to 4 quarters when you're doing a new market launch. Too many times they're too aggressive with the numbers and they don't give themselves enough time to learn about the local market. They don't give themselves enough time to basically build the business. It's a completely brand new business. So doesn't matter how successful you were back home in your home country, like all that stuff may not be relevant and usually is not relevant.
Final question. What one piece of advice would you have for your younger self?
Chill out a little bit more and just learn to be a lot more flexible. I, you know, just take things way too seriously, right? And freak about a bunch of stuff that, you know, you just sort of have some faith that you're just going to be able to, like, you'll figure it out and just be a little bit more patient. Try not to push a bad position.
Well, Marvin, thank you so much for these insights. I mean, one, talking about how maybe too much, there's some pitfalls around too much localization, going back to some of your stories about Yahoo and the importance of two-way innovation. How crucial it is to build an internal network and build that trust. And probably most importantly, as you highlighted at the end as well, is seeing is believing, right? Go out there, go see it, experience the market. So thank you very much for your time. And we wish you best of luck in working with more and more entrepreneurs from more and more countries and bringing their technologies to the world.
No, and thanks for doing this podcast and thanks for writing the book. It's something I could have used a long time ago.